KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
Ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before.
Talking about a subject.
Farewell to you, people.
It is Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. We are continuing our celebration and our series, Hip Hop is 50. And today we have a very special guest, somebody who's been in the trenches for a very long time. He is a historian, a writer, but he's also a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's worked with the legendary group Nice and Smooth, Curtis Blow, DJ Hurricane, Diamond D, and Grand Wizard Theodore. He was a seminal member of probably hip-hop's first superstar group, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. His name is Roosevelt Dynamite Simmons. It is a pleasure to have you on the show. Many of us have read your writings. You're an incredible writer who details so much of what has gone on in the past and currently. And I wanted to have you on because every year you highlight the importance of hip-hop's first MC, Cowboy, who is like your best friend and a fellow member of Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. So we had to have you on. I've been meaning to do this for a while, but we want to celebrate and talk about Cowboy as well as your legacy in hip-hop and find out why we need to better understand his role in the evolution of hip hop. So, Dynamite, welcome to the show. How you doing, brother?
ABD, first of all, it's a pleasure to be with you. You're one of my idols coming up as far as hip hop media and writing, and guys like you spurred me to write myself. But my history is deep. I mean, I started in this business around 1976, I was a DJ myself with a gentleman by the name of Coolione, who was another well-known DJ that hailed from the Bronx. And around that time, Cowboy had just started doing parties with Flash. And I was tagging along with Cowboy. Mostly it was a competition between him and myself at that time to see who was going to be the best. And he started, I want to say in the beginning, you want to call it hosting Flash's parties, but that turned into him being the first MC. When you would go to Flash's parties, you would see Flash so busy on the turntables that it was impossible for him to man the microphone at the same time. So saying that, you have to kind of look back at the history of DJs who rapped. You can't really talk about all of that without talking about DJ Hollywood, because he was probably one of the first cats that I know who was actually DJing and rapping at the same time. And you had a lot of figures that came after him. You had Lovebug Starsky, who also rapped and DJed at the same time. But when it comes to hip hop, see, those guys were disco DJs. So it's, you know, they have time in between the music to say a few words on the mic. But when it comes to hip hop, I think that the DJs are so integrated into the turntable, there's just not a lot of time for them to do that. So that's how the MC was actually born. So, you know, that kind of starts off how everything started.
When we talk about Flash being busy on the turntables, I know what you mean, but for our audience, describe what that means. What we're talking about in the 70s. So how could a DJ be so busy that he couldn't talk on the mic?
When it comes to Flash, if you've ever seen him live, you would understand, because at that period, he was like a blur, going from one turntable to the next, backspinning, needle dropping. All of this is a precise art form. So you really have to be there on time to the beat, or everything could easily fall apart. So I think that kind of signifies what I'm trying to describe.
We kind of take that for granted now, because we see DJs right. do so many tricks. But I'm thinking back, like in the 1970s, we're talking about 76, 77, you didn't have the fancy turntables that you have now. People weren't on That's computers. Right. So he was with vinyl, and he's outside,
right.
you know, without all the creature comforts of a club, and he's doing
right.
these.
He's actually, and all of that as well, he's actually got a guy, Easy Mike, standing next to him, handing him records to also help him accomplish what he's trying to do. So, you know, it was really hard to do that back then.
And so this is where Cowboy steps in. And what does he do exactly that separates him from anybody else who's talking on the mic at that time?
At that time, I think the big thing with Cowboy was the crowd participation part, because he was somewhat of a Pied Piper. This guy would have audiences eating literally out of his hands. Anything that he told a crowd to do, they would literally do. If he told them to jump off a roof, they would do it. Cowboy, throw your hands in the air. Wave him like he just don't care. Somebody say ho. All the ladies in the house say out. All of that stuff on the count of three, make your body freeze. He was like just a ringmaster, and so comfortable at telling crowds what to do. So that whole crowd participation and the crowd waving their hands, all of that stuff is Cowboy.
And that starts with him.
Don't know that. Yeah.
You know, it's so funny, we take all that for granted. That's like a standard in a party. You know what I'm saying? It's like we all do that now, but that's where it jumps off from. Did he have any idea why he started to do the crowd participation thing? Did he pick it up from somewhere? Or,
you know, it kind of just came natural, I think, because, you know, he's standing there next to Flash, and he's just as excited as the crowd. So I think that excitement kind of, you know, inspired him to have to do something, and that's what it turned into.
How did the other parts of the crew come together? Because when we talk about Flash's MCs, right, it starts off as the three MCs, and it's Cowboy, Melly Mel, and his brother Kid Creole, and then it expands to four with Mr. Ness, now known as Scorpio. But what was that like with the early dynamics of the group? You know, was Cowboy the one to kind of put everybody together? Was it Mel who was the leader? How did that kind of work?
Well, it was Cowboy that formed the Furious Five. In the beginning, Melly Mel, Scorpio, they were more breakdancers. They would come to the parties and dance, more or less. Before, you know, they ever got on the mics, they were breakdancers. And Melly Mel was the first one to come aboard, followed next by Kid Creole, and that formed the three MCs. With Melly Mel coming on, that led to more of the style of MCing that we're all familiar with today. That same cadence that MCs still use now is what Melly Mel brought to the table.
Right,
the complex rhymes.
And I think what we're talking about prior to that, the way that people rhyme was almost like pimp talk. It's something you had seen
exactly.
in the movie, like, yo, I'm Dave, and I'm here to talk to the ladies, and the ladies love
right.
Dave, and that
right.
sort of thing. But Mel and them was the one that's like, yes, yes, y'all, to the beat.
Right, right. Everybody else prior to that, if they rhymed at all, would rhyme in that same cadence of, I don't know if you remember the old radio station in New York, WWRL, with
yes,
Gary
do.
Bird
mm-hmm.
and those guys, and that's how they rhymed, like those radio jocks. Nowadays, you hear Coke LaRock come up after 50 years, now trying to claim the title of the first MC. Coke LaRock was a DJ who mimicked that WWRL kind of style when he said things on the mic. And don't get me wrong, all DJs prior to MCs said things on the mic, but it wasn't the rap that we know today.
With Cowboy and Mel, how did that dynamic work out? Because we know Mel because of the baritone voice, but we know Cowboy is the crowd pleaser, the MC. And also, you know, even though Mel was the big guy, it was really Cowboy who was the one that ran the show.
Exactly. Cowboy was the leader of the group in the beginning. The dynamic between the two was a close one in the beginning. Mel always gave Cowboy his room to operate and vice versa. They knew that they had a good thing tag teaming, and they saw how that worked together. So there was never any animosity between those two.
I mean, in terms of crafting routines and things like that, that's what I'm, you know, because what I always thought that separated, you know, there was a point where you had a number of crews. Right, you had Grand Wizard Theodore, you had the L Brothers, you had Baron and Breakout and the Funky Four Plus One More, Crash Crew, right? There were all these groups, but after a certain point, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Four, Furious Five, were just on a level all to themselves. They were like the Michael Jordan before Michael Jordan, you know? You talked about everybody else, and then you might consider being in the same space with Flash and him. And one of the things that always separated them for me was that they had showtime, prime time type of routines. And so I was always curious as to, you know, what was it like being in the room? Who crafted that? How did that come about? You know, especially knowing that Cowboy was such a prolific figure in that time.
I think Melly Mel would have to get the nod to that. A lot of the routines that they came up with, the harmonizing, that pretty much came from Mel. Mel would come in with an idea, and the rest of them would just add to it. I would think that that's how a lot of those routines came together. In fact, being that they wanted to get into more singing, when they did the it was a party night, everybody was breaking. Mel sung that originally. But this is what opened the door for Raheem to join the group, because Raheem was a better singer. And once Raheem joined the fold, they could do more singing as a part of just being rappers and MCs.
I want to see if you can clarify something for me. I've always said that harmonizing and singing has been a part of hip hop from day one. And you can have a group that sings in their hip hop. And others have said, no, once you cross that line, you're R&B. How have you always saw it? Because I always look back to the Force MDs, of course, the routines that you mentioned. But how did you all kind of, or did you even think that there was a line being crossed if you harmonized and sung?
No, I don't think they thought that at all. I mean, you got to remember, when these guys got together, the only thing that they had really to kind of compare themselves to was the Jackson 5. So that was all of our idols growing up. So you see a little of that in the Furious Five. I think that singing aspect, you got to remember, Hollywood was probably one of the first persons I heard singing and rapping at the same time. But I think when Raheem joined the group, that kind of solidified singing being a part of MCing as well.
How did you join the group? When did you enter in what phase?
Oh, again, that has to go back to 76, hanging out with Cowboy. I hung out with them and went to their parties prior to linking up with them. Once they signed with Sugar Hill, there was a need for somebody with a business kind of mind to kind of work with them. And, you know, nobody knew anything about the music business. And I was the only one around that time. I was still in college. None of them had went to school. They had dropped out of high school. So I was kind of like the natural choice. I don't want to say I was the smartest one, but I was the guy that the shoes fit perfectly. So once we got with Sugar Hill Records and I met the Robertsons, Sylvia saw the same thing in me as well. She, I became her point person. And that just led to me first being a roadie for the group, going on tour with them that way, then becoming their road manager, and then becoming their personal manager. So I've always been around them since around 1976. So it was just a natural progression. They had enough MCs. I was a DJ, like I said, myself, and an MC and rapping my own on my own. But there was just no more room in the group for that. But I did see a need for somebody to handle the business. So that's how I got involved.
What aspect of the business do you think stood out for you early on, considering this was a new venture for everybody? Sometimes I think it's an unfair rap that is levied on the pioneering class if they didn't reach Jay-Z mogul status immediately, you know? And folks are like, they should have read the contract, and they should have. And it's like, they forget that people were still teenagers coming from a place like the South Bronx, you know, into a new situation. So even if you did understand the business, and I'll let you explain if you saw a difference, I would imagine one could say, yeah, well, you know, the Jackson 5s and singing is different than this rap thing. We're going to have to kind of look at it a little bit differently. Instead of a dollar, you get 50 cents because it's a rap thing. It's not singing, you know. I mean, I'm sure they had some.
Funny you say that. Funny, keep that thought. But it's funny you say that, because when we first started touring, they wouldn't pay us as much as they paid Cameo and Lakeside and groups like that, because they said we didn't have a band. We had turntables. So they tried to use that on us.
Really?
Yeah. They wouldn't pay us as much as they paid R&B acts, because they said we used turntables and we didn't have a band. That went on for a long time.
But you all were turning out those acts. People forget that too.
They couldn't keep up with us. After a while, they had to put us on last. And, you know, once we started headlining, that's when the money started evening it out.
What about on the record side?
A bunch of stuff that I saw, like as far as even merchandising. You know, nobody was selling shirts, and we were missing a lot of money that way. It's just little things that I picked up on just from, you know, studying people. We had road managers that were constantly stealing money. So after a while, it's like, you know what? We don't need those guys. Dynamite can do that. So, you know, it was a progression. As I saw things and learned things, we just started to capitalize and bring it to everyone's attention.
You know, at a point, it seemed like there were two factions of the group. There was, you know, there was Melly Mel, and then there was the Flash side. Was that because of the business, or was it because the group was so big and it was, you know, a need to have two entities to cover the market? How did that kind of work out?
That happened when Sugar Hill was slow with royalties. As opposed to getting a royalty check and your statements every 6 months, Miss Rob would dole out money as you needed it. You would come up to Sugar Hill and say, hey, my rent's due, and she'd write you a check. So by the time royalty statements time came around, she would give you this piece of paper. Look, I gave Cowboy $10,000 here. I gave this guy $20,000 there. And that's how she paid royalties. Let me see. I'm straying from the question. The question again?
Well, no, I was asking how there wound up being two groups.
Two factions, right. The bad business at Sugar Hill led to the group wanting to leave at one time, the whole group. So they had a meeting at Miss Rob's house, and they told her that, you know, they weren't happy with the, you know, way the situation was, and that they wanted off the label. So Miss Rob was not letting anybody leave Sugar Hill. So everybody geared up for a long court battle. And in the midst of that, Melly Mel went back and recorded White Lines on his own, because he didn't believe our careers would last if we left Sugar Hill and had to sit on the bench for a long period of time. So that kind of led to the breakup. After Mel went back and did White Lines, Scorpio went back with Mel, and Cowboy just called me one night and said, Dynamite, I can't, you know, continue to hold out like this. They got a big hit record out over there at Sugar Hill. They're getting ready to do a movie. B Street was getting ready to be filmed, and we were going to be a big part of that. So Cowboy kind of made a decision for both of us. He went back, and I went back with him. And there we formed another group, Melly Mel, Grandmaster Melly Mel and the Furious Five. And that left Flash, Raheem, and Creole sitting on the sideline, still holding out, going to court for like, this went on for about 2-3 years before they even signed with Elektra. So that's kind of how the split up happened. Everybody went back to Sugar Hill out of necessity.
You would think that with this, with the visibility of Sugar Hill, that it would have been a slam dunk, that it would be good just to sign the groups and make sure that they were taken care of. Why do you think they just didn't see that vision, or did they, and they were just doing record industry shadiness?
It was the second, more or less. Sugar Hill was just used to doing business a certain way, and that's how they've been doing business from the 70s. Miss Robb learned the business the same way we learned the business, by getting taken advantage of. And once she became knowledgeable to the business, she just conducted business the way most record companies during that time conducted business. Those were standard contracts that all entertainers were signing during that period.
Let me ask you this. We're talking with Dynamite, who is part of the legendary Furious Five, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. Coming off the streets and having breakbeats as the backdrop for the emceeing, and that being the attraction for the DJ, how did you all adjust when signed to Sugar Hill to having a band, and a pretty good band at that? You know, everybody was kind of a superstar, you know, funk head in that, in those Sugar Hill bands. But how was there an adjustment to going to live music and recording records that way?
Oh, absolutely. Sugar Hill, that band was just out of sight. Those were some of the most dynamic musicians I have ever come across, being a musician myself. Those cats were top rate. But what that did, it kind of really, again, put a nail in the act, because now Flash is delegated. He's not, before that, Flash was doing all the music, so Miss Robb is not letting him produce anymore. He has no say-so on what we're going to do. Pretty much the Furious Five have no say-so on what we're going to do. Miss Robb will say, you're going to do this. So that kind of, the band, you know, it worked out for Melly Mel. I don't know. The rest of the group, you know, it didn't. It kind of splintered what we do best, and that was those party kind of rhymes and the syncopation and the switchovers between the Furious Five. All of that was put on the shelf for more of a Melly Mel kind of lead. You know, that itself, it put a lot of dents in the group. You know, everybody wanted to shine, and everybody felt that they were a talent. And why is everything being concentrated on Melly Mel? So that kind of added to the breakup as well.
You know, it's funny because I'm sitting here in 2023, and we're looking at all kind of hip hop acts that have live bands. You know what I mean? Like, that's almost par for the course. Like, who can sing? Who can play keyboards? We're looking for a drummer. And now that's kind of like the very thing that once upon a time you were dinged for. Everybody not only has, but some of the best. You know, I mean, you all had some of the best musicians on the Sugar Hill label. But now everybody's kind of in the market to get a top-notch musician so they can have a band when they go out.
Absolutely. LL is out right now with The Roots. Mm-hmm. So that says a lot, you know, of where it's going. I mean, hip-hop is going to always change. And I think it's going to always take a little bit from its past. And I just think if you have a bunch of funk musicians in your corner, it would be best to use that.
Comes back to the funk sooner or later.
Comes back to the funk, yeah.
What do you play as a musician? And also, did you grow up in New York? Because the thing I always tell people is, like, when I was going, by the time I got to high school, we didn't have a band. We didn't have musician classes. You know, all that was kind of cut off. Yeah. And then, you know, I run into somebody like Ed Lover, you know, or I'll run into DST, and they'll talk about, man, we was in bands, right? And they're musicians. So you as a musician, how did you navigate that at a time when hip-hop was showing up? When did you get to go and practice and hone your craft as a musician?
Well, it started for me, again, in public school in sixth grade with the song flute. And by the time I got to junior high school, I graduated to the clarinet. From there, I started playing saxophone and I stuck with the saxophone. And once through high school, I think about around the 10th grade, you started seeing the cuts that were happening in the lower grades. They were taking away all the music programs. Kids couldn't afford instruments. So again, I think all of that had a lot to do with kids now having to make music in other ways. And, you know, maybe that could, you could say that that was the beginning of kids drifting to turntables. But I studied with the jazz. I don't know if you remember the Jazzmobile workshop in New York. I studied at the Jazzmobile. And when I was 15, 16, 14 years old, I was playing in bands with older cats, man. I was in the Village and playing all these social clubs with my band. We had a band called Premier Odyssey. And as disco came about, that kind of put a nail in it for bands kind of too, because with that disco era, you started seeing more DJs. People, when they were doing wedding receptions, they wouldn't hire a band anymore. They would hire a DJ. And that kind of, you know, put the nail in the coffin for bands. I think DJs, the popularity of DJs, and like you said, the city taking away the music programs kind of played a big part in all of that.
Did you ever want to play on any of the records, or did you play on any of the records you all recorded?
No. I pretty much wrote. I'm a songwriter around that time when I get to them. So, you know, I came up with the hook for Internationally Known. I wrote Raheem's whole album that never saw the light of day, because again, Sugar Hill, after he left the label, he signed with Hank Shockley's label, Soul MCA, but Sugar Hill still had paperwork on him. So I had ended up producing and writing his whole album, and that never came to fruition, other than the single, Does Your Man Know About Me, was on the soundtrack for the movie Juice. And I wrote that as well. So I became a songwriter around that time, because the Furious Five wouldn't let me do anything, you know, other than manage them. As far as music and stuff, they wanted to keep all that to themselves.
I hear that. Let's come back to Cowboy, you know, your good friend. What are the fondest memories you have of him, and what do you want our listeners to know as his contributions outside of being a party rocker? But, you know, when we are celebrating 50 years, what do you absolutely want people to kind of know? Like, yo, you need to make sure you understand that this brother left these footprints in this culture.
Well, like I opened with, you know, it would be very important for everybody to definitely know that he is hip hop's first MC. And all of that, all of the crowd participation that he brought to the table, all of that's Cowboy. Without Cowboy, you know, I think that MCing would be a lot different if you never got to that crowd participation. I think MCs would be losing crowds if they couldn't stop after a rhyme and say, throw your hands in the air and use all that stuff for a bridge to get to their next rhyme. All of that, you know, played a key in the development of what we call MCing. And Cowboy played a big, big part in that. I definitely want everybody to remember that.
What about?
He was a good guy, man. He was just such a great guy. He would give you the shirt off his back. He helped families when he came home. He did just so much good in his community that's how everyone remembers him around that South Bronx area. Everybody's got a story of how Cowboy helped them at one time or another.
Well, the other thing that I remember is him and Lovebug Starsky, you know, coining the phrase hip hop. And, you know, Starsky, may he rest in peace. He has, you know, he says that him and Cowboy were hanging out and kind of coming up with it. But I never really heard Cowboy's take on how that happened.
How that happened. Yeah. We had a friend of ours. His name is Kokomo. And Kokomo was joining the army. And he came to a flash party. And Cowboy saw him and immediately started teasing him, going hip, hop, hip, hip, a hop, hip, hip, the hop, the hop. And he just kept doing it. And now around this time, Starsky is an up-and-coming DJ as well. And he's hanging out. He's opening parties for Grandmaster Flash, him and AJ. So he's hearing Cowboy with all this hip-hop stuff. And after a while, Starsky just started doing it as well. And Starsky just made it his signature, bob to the bob, the bang, and hip hop. So Starsky kind of kept the hip hop thing going, but Cowboy was the guy that came up with that.
And so we wouldn't have this genre with that name had it not been for him.
Had it not been for Cowboy.
We might be calling it R&B 2.0 or something like that.
Right. Or like a lot of the early hip hop flyers say, disco. It would just be an offshoot of disco problem.
That's crazy that we did call it disco back in the days. And I hated mm-hmm. disco. But I always tell people there was two types of disco. There was black disco and there was right. John Travolta disco.
Right, right.
And the disco that we liked was the black disco.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So it's funny that, you know, people just forget. I mean, you know, I think it's been 50 years, but time has gone by so fast for me. It doesn't seem that long ago that people wouldn't remember what happened. But here we have it, 50 years later, and the whole Bronx is arguing about who did what, and this one did that, and nobody can come up with one story of how hip-hop started. And I find that crazy.
Yeah, I think it's a long birth, you know, starting with the early parties all the way up into the recording of records. Mm-hmm. And so and to me, what I always remember, there's a big difference if you're 10 and somebody's 12, and there's a big difference if you're 12 and you got cousins who are 15 and 16, and a big mm-hmm. difference if you're 16 and you got cousins who are 18. You know what I mean? They're light years away because one ain't doing what the other's doing, not that's in the right. same space. And so I think that's where people get confused, because an 18-year-old who in the 70s is going to see it very different than somebody who's 10.
And an 18-year-old is at Club 371 listening to DJ Hollywood and Eddie Chiba, whereas the 10 and 12-year-olds are in the park breakdancing, listening to Flash. That was one of the things I thought about when I was like, well, you know what? They couldn't remember because they weren't really there like that.
No. And nobody had the wherewithal to go, you know, 40 years from now, this is going to be a big deal. You were just doing the activities. So nobody really, you know, thought, like, let's prepare for the future.
mm-hmm. We didn't think it would be a long, it would last this long. Everybody thought that hip hop was a fad.
Where do you see it going as we close out Dynamite?
Oh, my God. I think it's a wrap, buddy. I don't see hip-hop doing another 50 years. I mean, we're pretty much scraping the bottom of the barrel. When I listen to some of the lyrics that these kids are reciting, and I don't want to sound like my parents sounded when we started doing hip-hop. I try to be open to all this new stuff that these kids are doing, but there's just no more lyricism. It's just strayed so far away from what it was that they don't keep any of the real elements, I don't think, to the point where the labels are just signing the worst acts that come through the door. It seems like it's almost a conspiracy to destroy hip hop. The radio stations constantly playing this garbage music over and over again. You could have talented acts like The Roots release an album and you would not hear even the single on the radio. Black Thought had a beautiful album and we never heard one single from that album.
Yeah, so. I think commercially they're going to try and move it in another direction, but I think it's still going to be alive and well. I mean, we just had Hyro Day, and, you know, thousands and thousands of people were out for that. It's alive mm-hmm. and well, and, you know, and it's funny because, you know, I DJed some of that, and when you played a Roots song, people knew the lyrics and were singing right along, and when Common mm-hmm. headlined, it was like, man, it was magical, you know, and so you see that, and right. you contrast that to what's on the commercial side, and yeah, I could see the conclusion that it's dead, and maybe it needs to be dead on the commercial side because they didn't really invent it anyway. They just right. were scavengers who picked up on it, and now they're off to the next thing, but now it leaves us to kind of recreate.
To nostalgia. Yeah, well, it'll be nostalgia. I mean, you know, good hip-hop will never die. There'll always be an old radio station that'll still play old hip-hop music, and there'll always be older folks that'll still gravitate to old hip-hop shows. So in that aspect, I don't think hip-hop will ever die, but I don't see how it can progress anymore. But again, you know, I'm not of the age where my opinion counts or I can hear what these kids are doing to the fact that I can predict what's going to happen next.
Right. Last question. What was it like being inducted into Hall of Fame?
You know, that was an honor for me, especially that, you know, the Furious Five called and said, you know, Dynamite, you're a bigger part of this act as everybody else. You know, we definitely want you there for that. And, you know, I got to jump on stage with my guys one last time and do my hype man. A lot of people don't realize that I'm the first hype man. Nobody was doing that before me. That's how I ended up on stage with the Furious Five. I'm like, I got to get out on stage. They're not going to let me rhyme. So I've got to think of other things to do. So when Miss Rob came to me and said, Dynamite, at the end of the record, when they do that police part, I want you to dress up as a cop and go out there and act that out. And that's how I got my break. And ever since that part, I was always on stage with them, doing something crazy on stage so that I can get out on stage. When we did White Lines, I was the coke addict that came on stage with the cocaine in my hand and offered the crowd a hit. So it was always silly things that I did. So yeah, it was really a pleasure to join them again on that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame stage and to get inducted with them. So yeah, that meant a lot to me.
How do we get a hold of you, Dynamite? And you know, you're a prolific writer. You lay out a lot of stuff that is compelling reason.
You, that means a lot.
How do we get a hold of you?
My email is dynamiteny@gmail.com. You can always check out my Facebook page at Roosevelt D. Mite Simmons. And those are the best ways to get to me.
There you have it. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man. Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Davey D.
Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah.
Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy, though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Knock Woo.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Ain't nothing they made, they beats trying to eat till they're ready for the steel crate.
Real Talk Radio. You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coach. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
It's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication leads to complication. My emancipation don't fit your equation.
Bienvenidos y bienvenidas to PNN, Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. This is your co-host, Muteado Silencio, con voces de migrantes en resistencia, with Popoy and Poverty Scala. Tiny.
Yeah, this is PNN, not CNN, people. That's Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. Because we don't need more corporate about us without us. We don't need to be talked about without. And we don't need to keep being evicted, removed, eradicated, and destroyed by these settler colonial governments who only believe that Mama Earth is for sale. That's right. Mama Earth is not for sale. Not on these airwaves. That's PNN, not CNN.
We know that eviction happens before homelessness. We also know that and this system doesn't support our elders, especially our black and brown and indigenous elders.
The system, and I want to specifically break that down because a lot of people talk about system, but they don't understand what that means. I want to talk about a capitalist system that believes that Mama Earth is a commodity. I want to talk about a system that doesn't value the lives of black and brown and poor people anywhere. I want to talk about a system that supported and enabled the theft of Mama Earth from the first peoples of this land. We know that this system of gentrification is actively evicting, actively foreclosing, actively perpetrating acts of paper violence on so many of our relatives.
On today's show, we will be speaking to an elder right here from Black Arthur facing eviction after this music break.
And what you will, working for your dollar bill. Sad to see the old slave mill.
It's grinding slow but grinding still.
Walking home a youth gets killed. All is free to shoot at will. Sad to see the old slave mill.
It's grinding slow but grinding still.
9 to 5, you know the drill. Weekends are a sharp thrill. Sad to see the old slave mill.
It's grinding slow but grinding still.
Cup run it over till it's filled. Take until they've had their fill. Sad to see the old slave mill. It's grinding slow but.
With a heavy heart, but a hopeful heart, we are blessed to have one of those relatives in the studio with us today. A powerful elder who has been here over 50 years holding down a martial arts studio, pouring into our youth and our families on this very street, and is now struggling to keep his home and his studio right here on Black Arthur. Mr. Owens, welcome to Poor People's Radio.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Can you tell listeners a little bit about the history of your studio?
When I became an instructor, I didn't plan to become an instructor. I just love what the exercise did for me and other people. The fight part is part of martial art, and that seems to get most attention when people say martial arts. First thing you think about is Bruce Lee or Jackie Chan, and that's okay, as long as whatever it takes to get them to check it out, because once they're in the program, it takes them no time and before they realize this thing is about more than just fighting. It's really deep, and it is very deep. It gets really close to the heart and the soul. And if you don't believe in God, that's even better, because you will. You can't avoid that type of energy, because you're not going to know where that good feeling or that energy is coming from. There's no real name for it. The humans call it God, but it's okay. You'll know it's there. Anyway, I was fortunate enough to get into a program, and that instructor got called away to Denver, Colorado, and therefore I was one of the seniors in the class. In his few words, as the day before he left, it's what the reason I teach. He said, "Bill, I'm counting on you to keep everybody together." I'm like, "What?" I was a postal worker and working nights. And then the spiritual part began to set in, and I wanted others to know what I did. And then several things happened in the community that began to pull the business down. And one of the first majors was the housing crunch back in 09, 08, when they were just really had tricked people into taking these loans. And then they hit them with this balloon payment, and they were taking people's homes left and right. My home was one of those. So my wife and I moved into the back of the karate school. But along with that was the violence that so many people who are involved in the violence don't know how much damage they're doing to themselves and people they don't even know. They don't know who to be violent against. They're just violent. I admit there's some people you need to be violent against, but they're just violent without really any cause.
What matters is that this community needs you.
You know, I appreciate that. And the pandemic was rough on us because it was the type of business that you couldn't go home and do it with a computer. And the rules that we came under are the same rules that they apply to health studios and fitness centers. And that was no more than 6 people and had to stay so many feet apart. So, of course, that didn't work, and not to get enough income to stay afloat. We went to Zoom and we tried that, and that worked okay for adults. Doesn't work for the kids.
Right.
Kids need little hands on.
Totally.
So
we know.
that went okay. And now that the pandemic has ceased, and the studios are coming back, and the martial arts studios like this. There are a couple of them that are doing really well. I was just one that didn't do well. Then the systematic manner of taking people's property sets in. They got it so put together that it's hard to prove these things to where it can be proved that it's illegal. They'll say and tell you, but everything they do is legal. And what they did to me was, by some way in my contract, my interest rates went way up. For example, my monthly notes to pay that bill was $2,700 each month. And then in 1 month, no notice, $4,300. And then now I'm trying to talk to them, and they're not reachable. And then it's another month. They really work your mind, and you start feeling very inadequate. I've done this for so many years. I did this and did that. And they have a way of letting you know that you're not who you think you are. One question was, well, Mr.